Hell Yes Life, episode 49. Welcome to the Hell Yes Life podcast, the show that helps you come alive so you can live a hell yes life. I'm your host, Norman Bell. Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Hell Yes Life podcast. I am your host, Norman Bell. I hope you are doing great today. This is the place to hear inspiring stories and actionable tips from our amazing guests that will motivate you to live your Hell Yes Life. The Hell Yes Life podcast releases new episodes every Tuesday, and now with increasing frequency on Thursdays and Fridays. Hell Yes Lifers, if you want to write a review, please visit hellyeslife.com/HYLiTunes. Also, if you've been listening to the Hell Yes Life podcast and you're getting inspired by our guests and you're starting to think, hey, I want to live my Hell Yes Life, then I've got good news for you. Right now on hellyeslife.com, you can sign up for a free 5-part video mini course that will walk you through the 5 steps to a Hell Yes Life. This course will help you find your Hell Yes, create your cringeworthy vision, build your Hell Yes Day, plan your first Hell Yes action, and more. If you're ready to jumpstart your Hell Yes Life, then head over to hellyeslife.com right now. Okay, let's get into today's episode. Hell Yes Lifers, today my guest is Chris Ballew. I'm so excited. Chris Ballew was the lead singer of the hit 90s band, The Presidents of the United States of America. And he has also gone on to what he says is really his true calling, to become the hit children's singer, Casper Baby Pants, one of our absolute favorites around the house. I have a 7-year-old daughter, Sophia, and she absolutely loves Casper, and so do we. So you're going to really enjoy this conversation that I have with Chris, a.k.a. Casper. We talk about his early days busking in Boston, his rise to fame with the Presidents of the United States of America, and his subsequent career as Casper Baby Pants. But first, I told Chris that we were doing these other types of episodes called HYL Stories, and I asked him if he had a story that came to mind about a turning point moment in his life. Well, he said he did, and his turning point moment has something to do with an encounter with Madonna. So let's dive into that story and my interview with Chris Ballew.
So in 1994, my band, The Presidents of the United States of America, was a hot commodity, and about 7 different major labels wanted to sign us all at once. And so we had to make a lot of decisions really fast, and we whittled it down to 2 choices. One was Columbia, which is part of Sony Records, and the other was Madonna's label, Maverick, which was a small label, but it was Madonna, and she was very interested. So in order to figure this out, we had a business meeting with Madonna, which was pretty exciting. She had come to see our band the night before at the Dragonfly in Los Angeles, and she had on the typical baseball hat, sunglasses, sort of like the disguise that celebrities wear when they don't want to be recognized, but they absolutely look like celebrities trying not to be recognized. So anyway, she was pretty obvious. The next day we had a meeting, and we were there at the appointed time because as a band, we are incredibly punctual. So we were there, and she wasn't, and we were getting restless and waiting and waiting and waiting, and we decided to toss around this little Nerf football that we had with us that was our way of kind of getting a little exercise on the road. We'd stop at a truck stop or whatever and pull out the little football and fly around for a while to get our blood flowing from sitting in the bus or the van. So we were in the parking lot of her LA offices tossing this little football around, and somebody's head poked out of the door and said, "Hey, she's here. Come on in." And so everybody went in, but I was sort of feeling a little relaxed and not like rushing. So I was kind of tossing the football up in the air to myself and catching it. And the door had been propped open to the interior of the building. And I kind of thought to myself, I wonder if I could throw the football in an arc and have it land inside the hallway and me run into the hallway and catch it. Like, could I throw it to myself? And I did. I threw a high arc and ran and got in the hallway and landed with a big thunk, a big thud in the hallway on the carpeting and caught the football. And then I felt something by my foot. And I was wearing very thick leather boots, kind of 1920s brakeman railroad worker style work boots. And I felt something through the side of my boot. And I looked down, and to my horror was Madonna's dog. And at the time, she had no children. She had nothing else going on but this dog. If she was on the cover of a magazine or if she did a photo shoot, she had the dog. The dog was a little, tiny, extremely bone-frail chihuahua with a tennis ball-sized head. And it was looking up at me and shaking violently. And its little eyeballs were tearing up. And my entire system went blank, you know, like white with terror. And the dog was unharmed. I mean, it was so close to my boot that if I'd landed, you know, half an inch to the left, I would have crushed its little body completely. And nobody's in the hallway. Everybody's gone ahead. So it's just me and Madonna's dog alone in the hallway. And it's kind of like, I won't tell if you don't tell. And the dog just took off down the hallway and went around the corner. And I followed after a couple of heartbeats. So I'm very nervous, you know, from that. And I get in this office and she's still not there. And I'm looking at stuff on the shelves, you know, like albums and books, and kind of perusing with my back to the door. And she must have snuck in and sort of put her finger to her lips and told everybody to be quiet because nobody made a sound. But the next thing I knew, there was a tap tap on my shoulder, and I turned around and Madonna was right in my face, like 4 inches from my nose. And everybody laughs, ha ha, and she's like, I got you. So that's a good start. Then we have a very productive meeting. She really understood our attitude, how we wanted to make joyful music, how we cared deeply about making this, you know, music that sounded really easy. And she understood what we were trying to do. And it was a very positive meeting. And at the end, she kind of took me aside and she said, listen, whether you sign with me or not, I want to give you a piece of advice. And the advice was, you are funny and your songs are fun. So you will never receive, critical acclaim or validation for the craft and the hard work that you have to put into doing what you do. And she turned out to be very correct. And she saved me a lot of trouble, a lot of worry over, because, you know, on the other end of things, we ended up signing with Columbia and they were telling us, oh, you guys are important songwriters and you're a big deal and you're really like saving music at this point in life, you know, at this point in time. You're bringing humor back and everybody needs it. And, you know, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so Madonna's comment tempered my acceptance of that kind of praise and also made it so that I just focused on what made me happy, which was making this joyful music and spending energy doing it well, rather than trying to do it quick and easy and, just sort of fishing for compliments. So there you go. I went from almost killing her dog to receiving extremely valuable advice from her in about an hour.
That is awesome, Chris Ballew. Thank you so much for sharing that story. That felt, I was stifling back my giggles and guffaws along the way there. I was wondering if maybe it was going to round out with Madonna saying, yeah, well, actually I saw on the security camera that you almost killed my dog and therefore please get out of my facility.
Get out of the building. Yes. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. And thanks for starting our talk this way. And maybe we can go right into the theme that was brought up there. So basically, because of what Madonna said, you already prepared for this idea that, oh, okay, people are going to try to say that we're going to take us seriously, but do it for yourself. Do it for having fun. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like just that attitude towards things that you've carried throughout the work that you've done?
Yeah, I mean, that's the hell yeah attitude. Hell yes. Is it hell
it's
yes?
Hell
or
yes.
Hell yeah?
That's related to my own personal thing,
okay,
but hell
good,
yeah
good.
Works as well. Hell yeah, hell yes. Yeah.
That's a great Beck song. Isn't there a Beck song called
There
hell
is.
Yes?
There is.
Hell yeah. Yeah, yeah. I used to play with that guy. We can get to that later. But growing up, and when I was younger, and when I was starting out as a songwriter and a performer, I kind of immediately noticed that, you know, my childhood sort of version or picture of what it was like to become successful and famous was going to probably be unattainable. And so I started re-scripting my idea of success to be attainable, which was write a song, put it on a cassette, sell it out of my bag while I busked, you know, on the street or in the subway. And I felt happy with that, you know? So I wasn't looking, I was well-versed in the idea of creating my own version of happiness and my own version of success. So when all this opportunity came along to be sort of, you know, a big deal or whatever on the cover of magazines, on MTV, and, you know, play the game and do that thing and swim in those waters, I was really skeptical of it anyway. But the process of being courted by seven major labels had sort of upended my my perspective. And when she made that comment to me, it kind of regrounded me. And so I went ahead and did it, but I always felt like, you know, a little suspicious, it's a little bit of shaky ground to plant yourself in, you know, like, because, you know, fame is fickle. And if you really base your happiness on, you know, achieving the criteria that you need to be a certain level of success, successful, it's probably going to go away and it's probably going to evaporate and it's going to be a lot of pressure. And so I just kind of navigated the whole thing with an attitude like, I'm enjoying it and these are great opportunities and we're playing for a lot of people and we're making people happy and everything. But then there was another layer, which was like, this is not where I am going to, you know, really put down my roots, which is what led me to Casper Baby Pants, which is making music for families and kids and doing it myself, running my own label, booking my own shows, making my own records. I even master the records myself. So I'm the only one I can yell at if things don't go well. So, and I like that. I like that. For me, that's happiness. Happiness is being able to make a decision, at the, you know, drop of a hat that benefits my happiness. You know, like for instance, a couple of years ago, 3 years ago or so, I just realized that, you know, playing Casper Baby Pants shows in the hot sun in the summer is really not that fun. So I'm just not going to play in the summer. And that makes me happy. So I get to like be a kid instead of play for kids. So for 3 months every year, I just stop and I just enjoy life. And if I were in a band, I'd have a pretty hard time convincing people to do that. So
yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I don't know. I might have veered away from the actual question, but I hope that sort of illuminates the idea that creating your own definition of success and happiness is a lot more. I mean, you can probably achieve it a lot quicker and with more joy than trying to follow the beaten path to the top of the pops.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the reasons I reached out to you is, you know, you strike me as someone, I've watched maybe some interviews with you and of course listened to a lot of your, actually more of your Casper Baby Pants albums than your President's albums. And you know, just the joy that seems to emit from you, like you're someone who found fame and success, and yet it seems like you've gone on to something else that was even more your, you know, your passion and purpose. And it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't being in a rock band. That was just like, you know, a stop on the way to something that was a better fit for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I knew that from the very beginning too. I mean, the moment the band got signed, I was like, I want out.
Yeah. 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 So why don't we take a step back and take us to the early days for the Presidents. And, you know, I understand that you were busking in Boston, but, you know, I always like to start off by asking people, you know, what is your hell yes? So what would you say it is? I mean, it sounds like the obvious answer would be creating music, but what is it in your words?
Well, for me, it's the moment when I sort of It's the moment when a new song really sparkles to life, whether that's in the writing or in the recording. It's that, like, I made something out of nothing, and now it exists, and it is alive, and it's a world, and it paints a picture, and it makes me, like, jump around the studio and smile and laugh. And or if it's like a mellow song and puts me to sleep, or whatever the song's purpose is, it's like clear and functioning. And yeah, that just makes me, I mean, I don't want to sound like I have delusions of grandeur, but it makes me feel like a god. Because it's like,
yeah,
I created something that is going to make, well, first of all, it makes me feel really good. And that's kind of the first step of the whole thing. And then if I, you know, if it can go out in the world and make other people feel good and make families sing together and share a moment, that's it. That's my hell yes, is like, yeah. And, you know, I know when I listen to a song I've recorded, if I don't do the hell yes, if I don't go hell, you know, it literally go hell yes, then, you know, it's back to the drawing board for that song, or it's got to get hacked up or figured out or reconfigured or remixed or something. So I use the hell yes as my barometer for
that.
Success,
is awesome to hear. Basically. And yeah, I can hear that. Like, we talk a lot on the show about coming alive, what actually makes you come alive, animates your body. And I can hear you say that, like, you that moment when the song kind of lights you up and comes alive. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Can you recall a moment, no pressure if you can't remember, like, oh, it was when I was 4 years old in the sandbox or something, but an early moment when you realized this was your hell yes, you know, creating that one of those first songs.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, it's before I even created. It was when I was 2.5 years old, and my brother, who's 17 years older than me, he bought Sgt. Pepper's in 1967 for my parents for Christmas. It came out in June 1st, 1967, and he bought it for them that Christmas 6 months later. And my parents didn't really get it or understand it or want it, as I recall, and I just loved it. I mean, that's all I listened to. It's all I wanted to do was listen to Sgt. Pepper. So my first hell yes was listening to that record and being sort of sucked into each song's kaleidoscopic, vivid visual world. And that's, you know, I think I'm forever trying to get back there. You know, by writing my own songs that transport me to a vivid world, I'm trying to get back to the 2.5-year-old me that said hell yes to the Beatles. And
that is so cool. And I happen to know, because I know your repertoire, that you have a couple of baby Beatles albums, and there's a lot of the Sgt. Pepper songs on there. So that must have been fun to do that.
Yeah, that's why I did those Casper Beatles cover albums, because I wanted to kind of, you know, really swim in those waters again and understand the songs from, like, you know, like dissecting a frog. I wanted to kind of, like, tear them down to their bones and kind of understand them and then make them my own. And that was a fun and hard project. That was a lot of work. So I loved it. It was great.
Awesome. So tell us about those early busking days in Boston back before, you know, any of the fame or even the inception of the Presidents. You were in a band called Egg. What kind of stuff were you doing at that time?
Well, some of the same songs actually were in there, but that was, Egg was pretty similar to the Presidents, really. You know, my attitude about being in a band is I always wanted a band to feel kind of like broken or lacking something. You know, I always thought, like, if the band could be dinky and try to rock, then the crowd would have an empathetic reaction to the band. Like, look at that poor little band trying to rock. You know, I want to put them in my pocket. They're so cute.
Like, aw.
I figured that was better than actually rocking, because actually rocking, you know, a lot of people can do that. You just turn it up and make a bunch of noise. But I wanted to do something a little more dorky. And so Egg was the first attempt to do that. Egg was proto-Presidents, really. It was the drummer played a drum set that would, the kick drum was the suitcase that the entire drum set fit in. So he would upend the suitcase and attach a kick drum pedal to it, and that made sort of a hollow thud. And then he had a little tiny snare drum and cymbals and a couple of bongos. And I played a really old Sears. It was my first experience playing an old Sears guitar, which now that's all I play, are harmony and Sears in Silvertown. I got it at a thrift store in upstate New York for like $25. And now I see the same guitar and amp combo in music stores for like, you know, $1,000. But I scored it for $25 in upstate New York. And then the bass player played kind of a regular old bass, but through a tiny amp. So it was all kind of messed up and kind of, you know, lacking. And then when the president started, we really had that same thing. That's why we took away strings and we took away all of Jason's cymbals and kind of, you know, tried to dorkify the music as much as possible. So Egg and the presidents, Egg and the beginning presidents were pretty similar, you know, just different personnel and different, mostly different songs, but a few crossovers.
Mm-hmm. And somewhere in the middle, you were playing with Beck. Is that right?
Actually, that was after the president started. So the president started up in December of 93 was our first show. And then Jason joined. Our first show with Jason, I think, was December of 93. And then that spring of 94, or actually more like midwinter into spring, is when I met Beck, who moved to L.A., lived with him, recorded with him, performed with him, joined his band, went on two tours. And then the presidents, we had done a demo tape that Jason, who was a bartender, was selling over the bar at the place where he worked. And he called me one day during the second Beck tour and was just like, hey, you got to get home. Like, we're selling tons of these cassettes and we got to get back on the pony. So I quit playing with Beck and went back and did the presidents. And then, and then eventually the presidents and Beck would share bills on a couple of, you know, radio shows in the future. And so that was kind of satisfying and fun. But yeah. So yeah, that's when I played with Beck, was in between the president starting and taking off.
Very cool. Very cool. I was looking at an article from earlier this year, and it just mentioned how you were going on long walks in the Hollywood Hills with Beck, talking about how celebrities sort of impeded musical creativity. Can you talk a little bit about that time?
Yeah, I think the main topic of conversation was sort of marveling. He was, as I remember it, marveling at the sort of blandness of popular music and how people weren't really taking a lot of risks. He felt like if you got that platform, you should take risks and, you know, push the medium and be more surreal and daring. And, you know, I agreed for sure. But I think he was kind of trying to focus his the challenge. Like, he felt pretty challenged, I think, by the transition. And so we talked about the challenges of the transition. Like, he stopped smoking pot. He stopped drinking, you know. Typical image of Beck on that first van tour was him in the back of the van with Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States of America, just like reading the entire thing, absorbing history and culture and kind of getting his head out of the sand and sort of gearing up to take advantage of the opportunity and taking it seriously, you know, like. So that's kind of what we talked about a lot, was that idea. And, you know, it was nice for me because my band had already started, but we weren't successful. So I got to kind of stand next to the eye of the storm as far as the fame transition goes and watch him go through it. And then I got to be in my own. So I always say that playing with Beck was like fame school or success yeah. school, you know. Yeah. I can't believe I got that opportunity to do that, but it really helped. Between the experience with Beck and the advice from Madonna, I survived.
Yeah. Yeah. And it wasn't long after that you were in the center of the storm yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was cool. And I got to kind of draw upon that previous experience with Beck to kind of keep myself centered.
Yeah. So take us to the center of the storm just briefly. What was that like? I mean, I've read that you were, or as you've just said as well, like, you were always a little bit skeptical of it. You know, fame can go to a lot of people's heads. It sounds like you kept yours during that time. But, you know, just kind of take us there. Like, your first album is taking off, your singles are going up the charts. What was that like?
This is Chris Ballou calling from the center of the storm. It's intense in here. There's a lot of pressure from the major label. Oh, I gotta get some rest.
It was kind of like that. Yeah, it was it was super disorienting and very stressful. Like the entire my entire life was about hanging out with my friends, playing frisbee. Every day was random and weird, and we would end up maybe barbecuing in the end of the night or watching a movie or riding our bikes around the neighborhood. And it was just we were like big kids, you know, just really enjoying ourselves. And all that joy got put in the songs and the music, and the joy of finally living back in Seattle after living on the East Coast for many years. And then the success from that bottling of the joy ended up taking us away from the source of the joy. Mm-hmm. So it was real weird. It was like, here's something that I sort of put a lot of energy into telling myself I didn't need and didn't want, you know, rewriting that idea of success. But really, you know, in the back of my mind, I was like, you know, if we got the opportunity, if I ever got the opportunity, I would absolutely take it. So I take it, and then it's really upended my life and, you know, disconnected me from my friends and my family and put me in lonely, kind of isolated environments of hotel rooms and backstages. Meanwhile, very public environment of being like sort of in the spotlight and in front of a lot of people. So there's all these like contradictions, and like the thing I thought I wanted, secretly wanted, is actually something I really don't want. But how do I get back? You know, the road back is closed now, and I'm just stuck going forward. And you know, when you have those thoughts and the rest of your bandmates and everyone around you is super into it and just digging in, and you're the one that wants to, you know, run away, then the sort of fortitude that I would have had to call upon to disappoint everybody, I couldn't call upon. So I had to sort of, you know, suppress my own desires and needs. And then that became a festering wound that eventually exploded. And so it's just all this, like, just a maelstrom of contradictions is how I would, which is also my heavy metal band.
Maelstrom of contradictions.
Yeah. Maelstrom of contradictions. That's the album title. Actually, we're called Smooth Death.
That's what we should all hope for. A smooth death. This is a kind of a random side note, but I was over the summer watching this documentary about the Grateful Dead. And at the beginning of it, you know, Jerry Garcia was talking basically like, hey, all I want to do is have fun. I'm not interested in creating something that will last through the ages. And yet by the end of his life, he had created something that sounded like what you were talking about. He had created something so big that he felt almost obligated to go out there so he wouldn't disappoint all the deadheads. And he was very isolated in his hotel room because he couldn't go out because everybody was worshiping him and everything. So, fame is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, there's stuff like Eddie Vedder had a woman drive a truck into his house while he was gone and lived there. And he tells it like, you know, he started making music to break down walls between him and people. And then he ended up having to build physical actual walls in order to survive the success of his other attempt. And it's kind of like the Beatles too. You know, the Beatles were this incredibly funny, fun band, real weird, kind of arty, you know, didn't fit in with the sort of blue collar worker, working class rock and roll scene. They were more art school, bizarre, and having fun, and then their success really cut them off and like really isolated them. That movie, 8 Days a Week, really sheds light on how scary and dangerous and crazy their first touring experiences were. And it's terrifying. I mean, it's really, like, the world was not ready for that. So anyway, having even just the slightest sort of, you know, faded version of what they experienced, I can attest to how sad it can be. Now, nobody wants to hear somebody who's been famous say that it's a sad experience, but it is. And, you know, like, nobody talks about that. And everybody, you know, we were so fame obsessed in this culture, but on the other side of the curtain, it's kind of a sad place. I'll never forget seeing Rodney Dangerfield when he was about to go on. I was backstage with Rodney Dangerfield. He was going to go on Leno. And he was a absolute, like, just stone-faced, bummed-out dude. And then the curtain parted and the light went on him and he went out and he just turned on like a puppet, like a robot, and did his thing. And it was great. It was super funny and everything. And then when he came back, I was watching him on the monitor from backstage, and then he comes back and he just goes back to fallen face. And anyway, I find the truth about fame way more interesting than the myth.
Yes, I think it's something that people need to hear because I think... You know, we like you said, we're fame obsessed in this country, and people see that as, oh, that's my hell yes, is when I get to that level of fame and notoriety.
Right.
But okay, so I want to be mindful of your time, and let's move on to the happier part of this, when the presidents started to become less popular, paradoxically. so you could talk to us briefly about that sort of after that peak period, what happens, and then into your present incarnation.
Yeah. Well, the entire time I was with the presidents, I had this very clear voice in my brain saying, congratulations on your success, but you are not finished looking for your actual voice. So keep looking. So the entire time we were touring around the world, on the side, I was experimenting. I was building up a home studio and trying things and working like a dog to figure out what this thing was. Really, I couldn't figure it out. And in 1997, my dissatisfaction brimmed over and I quit the band really abruptly. We broke up for 5 years, but during that 5 years, we formed a band with Sir Mix-a-Lot and recorded a record, and we made our own President's record that was just a recording project. We never toured on it. And during that time also, during those 5 years we were broken up, I was searching for this other voice and trying all kinds of different things. And none of it was working, really. So, but the nice thing was that when we finally did figure out that we wanted to play together again, I reapproached it and really understood the value of what we'd created, that I'd kind of been sort of distracted by my own sort of restless dissatisfaction and didn't really see the value of our contribution. And then when we got back together in 2002, the end of 2002 for New Year's Eve, the rehearsals leading up to that really were interesting because I felt like I was in a President's cover band. I felt like I was in a really good President's cover band. And it was liberating because I felt like I hadn't written the songs. And so I got to enjoy it again in a way that wasn't about climbing the charts, but that was just about like, oh, let's just enjoy what we do best. Still, I couldn't figure out this other thing. And still, the President's wasn't it. And many years go by. And finally, in about 2008, after having met my second wife, Kate, I started feeling like her artwork really was speaking to me. And it's very bright, sunny, funny, animal-based collage artwork that's very innocent but well-made and simple and intriguing and just great personalities of the characters. So I started writing songs that sort of sounded like her artwork. And then the gigantic cartoon light bulb went off over my head. Oh my goodness, hell yes, I'm supposed to be making kids' music. And it was such an incredibly satisfying hell yes moment because I could, you know, the presidents worked because we had this friction between innocent themes and innuendo. You know, like Peaches, Kitty, all that, you know, is that sexual or is it just the kid's song or whatever, or innocent? But I was never really comfortable with that chemistry. I didn't really know how to call upon that chemistry. That chemistry was part of a time of my life, but then it was gone. And I was, you know, the pressure to repeat it was part of what drove me away from the band. But without the innuendo and with just the innocent core, the volcano of songs erupted, and I am, what is it now? That was 2009. I put out my first. It's 2017. So that's 8 years later. I've got 13 records out and no end in sight. Just absolute, like, gushing volcano, and going back over old songs that I wrote that never made it out to the light of day, and realizing, oh, that was trying to be a Casper Baby Pants song. Like, I was trying to be this guy the entire time. So that's what kind of led me to now. And then about 2 years ago, I officially quit the presidents again. We disbanded, but we did it real quietly and very unemotionally, and just kind of like, you know, I figured out the mechanisms of why I couldn't quit before, and the combination of figuring things out and then also feeling like, well, we've been playing these songs for 23 years on, give or take. And, you know, there's a certain point where you know, your pants don't fit anymore and you get a new pair of pants. So that I just was like,
Casper,
I need a new pair of
pants
and make them baby pants.
Yes, indeed. And okay, I've got to ask, like, where did the name come from? It's such a delightful, wacky name.
Yeah, it was my stage name. I was in a band with this guy, Mark Sandman, who is the lead singer and two-string bass guitarist for Morphine from Boston, Massachusetts. Yep, he and I were roommates. He let me live with him, and he turned me on to the two-string thing, and we had a band called Supergroup, and my sort of stage name or whatever persona in that band was Casper Baby Pants, because I had changed my name to Casper to do some noisy, weird experimental music cassettes, and then I started wearing a pair of baby's pants as a winter hat in Boston, and the kids in my neighborhood started calling me Baby Pants. So I put the Casper and the Baby Pants together, and so back in 1991 or so, 90, 91, 92, when I was in Boston playing with Mark, I was known as Casper Baby Pants, and you can find pictures of this online. So when I was doing kids music, I was just kind of scratching my head thinking, well, what am I going to call it? You know, is it my name? Do I make up a name? And then suddenly another giant light bulb went off and I said, hell yes, I am already Casper
awesome.
Baby Pants.
Love it,
so
love it.
I will be Casper Baby
okay,
Pants.
Well, I could go on like this for a while, but I want to be mindful of your time. But before we go, I wanted to ask, just imagine our listeners out there, they've just listened to you basically say, fame sucks, or, you know, something along those lines. And maybe they're early in their journey. You know, they might be back when you were busking, or even before that, they're haven't quite identified what their hell yes is yet. What would you say to those people, as far as any tips or advice as they're moving forward to try to pursue that thing that really lights them up and makes them come alive?
Yeah. Well, the number one thing would be know yourself, figure out what you like and what you don't like. You might be the person who likes that intensity of having to reinvent yourself and recapture audiences and being under pressure. And, you know, that might be you. It isn't me. I'm not really saying fame sucks. I'm just saying that it's a bait and switch, you know, and if you understand it and understand yourself and how you relate to it, then you can find your place in it. And it might be not that you're supposed to be a star on a stage. It might be that you're supposed to be a producer in a studio, or, you know, where does your particular chemical brain fit into the sort of puzzle or the maze of this operation of music and making it and performing it, you know? So really get to know yourself and take time to know yourself. You know, I didn't sort of quote unquote hit it big until I was, how old was I? I was 30 years old. So that's one thing about hanging out with Beck. He was so young but so like aware and focused. That really impressed me. He was like, I think he was 22 or 23 and I was 28 or 9 when we were hanging out. So anyway, take time to get to know yourself. That's what I would say. Your hell yeah exists in not in the future and not in the past, but in the very razor thin moment of self-awareness.
Absolutely.
And on that note.
And on that profound note from Casper Baby Pants, let me ask you.
Wait. I have one. Yeah. Wait, I have one more profound note. Here's a profound note.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yes. Do it. That was profound. I love that. That made me really.
It really was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know you have your guitar there. Is there any? And I know we're kind of running out of time, but is there any anything you'd like to play? Just a minute of before we go. I know you have a new album out, Jump for Joy. Anything come to mind?
Yeah.
That you'd like to play?
Sure. Let me try a tiny bit of this song. It's called Free Couch. I think I don't remember. I don't memorize any of my songs, and I don't have my lyrics in front of me. But I think I remember the first verse. This song is about a tick that moves from the city to this, I'm sorry, from the country to the city. And he's calling his mom and dad on the phone to say, you know, he's moved into an abandoned couch, a free couch. So he's calling his parents to say, don't, mommy and daddy, don't freak out. I'm living in a free couch. And it goes like this.
Hey, mommy and daddy, it's me, your baby Tick, calling from the city, 'cause I know you're worried sick. Don't you fret, don't fret about me. I found a place to live, and first of all, it's free. Mommy, don't freak out, I'm living in a free couch. Daddy, don't freak out, I'm living in a free couch. Hanging out with the Ticks in the city. Look me up if you want to get down, but please don't freak out, mommy and daddy, I'm living in a free couch. Yeah. Free couch. The life of a Tick is short and boring. I had to mix it up, and I felt like exploring. So I went to the city to make it on my own. Someone left this couch in the street, and now it is my home. Mommy, don't freak out, I'm living in a free couch. Daddy, don't freak out, I'm living in a free couch. Hanging out with the Ticks in the city. Look me up if you want to get down, but please don't freak out, mommy and daddy, I'm living in a free couch. Yeah. A free couch.
And then I'll skip the solo and I'll do the ending.
Free, 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 free couch. Free, 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 free couch. Free, 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 free couch. Free, 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 free couch.
Woohoo! Hell yeah. Yes! Thank you so much, Chris.
Yeah, I skipped the third verse in the solo just to, you know.
So oh, man, that was awesome. You know, you have such a talent for, and I thank you for this as a parent, for making music. And I saw that you said that this was your goal, was to make it enjoyable for everybody in the family. So, you know, thank you so much for
doing that. Yeah, but the thing I say is I really make parents' music, but there's no genre called parents' music, so I have to call it kids' music. But if there is a genre called parents' music, I'm going to be the first to
sign
up.
God bless you for that. Thank you. So lastly, tell us where on the internet we can find you.
Yeah, the best one-stop shop is babypantsmusic.com. And from there, you can listen to some songs, you can watch some videos and go out to YouTube or Facebook or see, you know, where I'm playing shows and look at pictures. And also on the website, which is kind of fun, I have all the lyrics with tabs so you can play the songs with your kids. I have all the origin stories for all the songs. So you can find out like maybe what the public domain song is that I'm altering to make this new thing, or what the, you know, where the songs came from, that kind of stuff, which are fun to read, I'm told. They're fun to write, but I'm also told they're fun to read.
Awesome. Awesome. Looking forward to doing that myself. Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us today. I always like to close out our time together by saying hell yes together on the count of three. Are you ready to do that?
I'm ready.
Let's do it. One, two, three.
Hell yes!
So yeah, that was a good one. Thanks a lot, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Norman. Thanks for taking time to talk. I appreciate your help helping me spread the word about what I do. So that's cool.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Hell Yes Life podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite RSS feed. If you like the show, please leave a rating and review. And if you want to stay connected, visit hellyeslife.com and sign up for the e-newsletter and private Facebook group. Again, I'm Norman Bell. Thanks for joining me. Now let's get out there and live a hell yes life.